As Russia's war in Ukraine nears the three-month mark, what could be learned from Moscow's performance on the battlefield?
So I think going into this, Russia made a set of critical assumptions that were incorrect.
Plus, Kyiv begins its first war crimes trial against a Russian soldier.
The Russian was provided with a free lawyer and with an interpreter. He's charged with two counts. First one is murder, and second one is violation of the laws and customs of war.
And later in the program, efforts in the United States to send medical aid where it's needed in Ukraine. Today is Friday, May 13th, and from the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. The European Union said on Friday that it's paving the way to send an additional 500 million euros, which is about 520 million US dollars, to buy heavy weapons for Ukraine to fend off the Russian invasion. Josep Borrell, the EU's High Representative for Foreign Policy, made that announcement at a gathering of top diplomats from the Group of Seven wealthy nations, where he also discussed efforts to wean the bloc off Russian energy sources.
I'm sure we will have an agreement. We need this agreement, and we will have it, because we have to get rid of the oil dependency from Russia.
Speaking to reporters on the sidelines of the meeting, Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, challenged the EU to impose an oil embargo on Russia, saying that Vladimir Putin would celebrate if the proposal fell through. Ukraine's neighbor, Hungary, has opposed the plan, which requires unanimity to pass. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading to Germany and France on Saturday for NATO and trade meetings. This comes after U.S. Senator Rand Paul, who is a Republican, defied leaders of both major U.S. parties and single-handedly delayed Senate approval of an additional $40 billion to help Ukraine in its fight against Russia. The legislation was approved overwhelmingly by the House of Representatives and has strong bipartisan support in the Senate. The AP's Mike Gracia takes it from here.
Senate leaders from both parties were hoping for quick approval of a fresh $40 billion aid package for Ukraine and its allies Thursday.
We have a moral obligation to stand with Ukraine.
I strongly support the next package of lethal military assistance, which the House has passed with an overwhelming bipartisan majority.
But the package was held up until at least next week. Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky declared he would not allow speedy passage.
My oath of office is to the national security of the United States of America. We cannot save Ukraine by dooming the U.S. economy.
The latest bill, when added to $13.6 billion approved by Congress in March, would raise U.S. aid to the region since the Russian invasion well above $50 billion. The Senate is recessed until Monday. Mike Gracia, Washington.
According to Kyiv, Ukraine has opened the first war crimes trial against a Russian soldier since the war in Ukraine began in late February. Anna Chernikova is in the Ukrainian capital, and I caught up with her recently to discuss the trial.
Today is the first day of the criminal case. So Solominsky District Court of Kyiv granted the request of the prosecutors and appointed a criminal case against the Russian soldier, 21-year-old Vadim Shishamarin. He is accused of killing a civilian in the Sumy region, which happened at the beginning of the invasion. The Russian was provided with a free lawyer and with an interpreter. He's charged with two counts. First one is murder, and second one is violation of the laws and customs of war. So far, neither the defendant nor his defense counsel have voiced their position. At the same time, the prosecutor said that during the investigation, Shishamarin admitted his guilt, repented, and cooperated with the investigation. The prosecutor claims that the guilt of the Russian soldier is provided not only by his words, but also by the expertise and testimony of the witnesses. And the next trial of the Russian is scheduled for May 18.
There, of course, are additional war crimes investigations being carried out by the prosecutor general in Ukraine. But I want to also ask you about efforts to extricate the fighters in the Azovstal plant in Mariupol. What is known about the fighting taking place in and around the plant and efforts to retrieve the Ukrainian soldiers there?
Throughout the night, tonight, Russian soldiers were shelling Azovstal and they're trying to break through to the Azovstal territory. So the shelling they did with the artillery and aircraft currently the assault is on the way. So as I already said, Russian soldiers are trying to get on the territory in the plant. In terms of evacuation, very difficult negotiations are ongoing. So for the moment, what we know, the Deputy Prime Minister Irina Verishuk, she confirmed that almost done the agreement, but basically evacuation should begin with the seriously wounded soldiers. So we have a hope that Russian side would confirm that. So the new round of talks are ongoing and these talks are on the roadmap for the evacuation operation. There is Red Cross and UN who are engaged in that.
Anna Chernikova is reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you.
Thank you.
As the conflict in Ukraine approaches that three-month mark, I spoke with Dara Masko, senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation, about what the war has shown thus far about the military might of Russia.
So I think going into this, Russia made a set of critical assumptions that were incorrect. So if you do the very high levels, how they planned this operation, it was something that was multiple fronts, too many fronts for a force size for what they had to put against it. They really didn't consolidate and have a main line of effort in the beginning of this, and it stretched their lines to the point of breakage. So you see them, you know, a few weeks into this war, essentially pulling back from one of their key objectives near Kyiv. Another assumption that they had that was faulty, and this is a big one, was about Ukrainian will to fight and their capabilities to resist them. And when you look at the footage from the early days of the war, it almost seems like they're not really expecting a resistance at all. They're expecting people to essentially greet them positively, and none of those things happened. Ukraine is also receiving significant amounts of not only material support from the United States, but also really tactical intelligence. We know this from different types of disclosures that have been made, and it's really making a difference on the battlefield for Ukraine.
I wanted to ask you about this. Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, on Wednesday, as well as other officials, have said that this appears to be a conflict that is going to be, you know, long in nature. Some other analysts have said, you know, 18, 24 months. Perhaps. What does the Russian strategy show in terms of being able to carry out that kind of offensive for so long, given the setbacks it's had?
So they have pulled back and reconsolidated into a more simple plan that should allow them theoretically to maximize a lot of their advantages, shorter logistics lines, ability to focus their firepower. And I put an asterisk by it should help them. So far, it is not. There is a slow change, slow movement forward from the Russian side, but the Ukrainians are actually able to push them back in unexpected ways, even in the Donbass. So can it grind into a stalemate? Yes, it can. That depends on whether or not Ukraine's supporters continue to essentially supply them. And it also depends on whether Russia can make meaningful progress and try to envelop some Ukrainian forces in the east.
Earlier this week, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that at least for the moment, there doesn't appear to be any serious efforts to bring about the hostilities to a peaceful remedy. As someone who watches Russia, who's familiar with Russian politics, who is familiar with Russian military strategy, what things are you looking at that may signal where Putin may be headed if a diplomatic solution can be achieved?
Sure. I agree with that assessment. I don't really see an external peace process starting right now. Russia would like to return to the Minsk agreements or something like that. I don't think that's possible anymore for many reasons. In terms of where this goes and how they can essentially sell a victory to the Russian people, they are going to potentially say that they've liberated the Donbass, Luhansk, and Donetsk oblasts, maybe a few additional south of Kharkiv and linking upwards from Crimea. They may say that they've liberated, you know, the Russian-speaking eastern heartland of Ukraine and, quote, you know, denazified it. That might be how they sell a limited victory for now. It's certainly short of what they originally wanted, which was essentially regime change, to have a pro-Russian leader in place, or at least have NATO membership permanently off the table and in a sort of legally binding way. They didn't get that. So strategically, Russia has not, and I don't think will, certainly this year, have anything close to its strategic objectives that it started out hoping for at the beginning of this war. I just wanted to add, looking at Russian military performance in this conflict, it is clear that despite the significant investment that Russia has made in modernizing its forces and even making attempts to change its training programs and personnel policies to be a modernized force, there's still something fundamentally wrong going on. And with the excessive amount of secrecy that went in on the Russian planning side and how they've poorly equipped their troops going in, I think there's still sort of a fundamental disregard for the personnel, and that's why they're experiencing these problems. It's a systemic sort of a failing, and that's not one that they can easily correct on the battlefield right now.
Dara Masico is a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. Thank you very much for your insight.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for calling.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Finland's government on Thursday said the country would immediately apply to join NATO in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, abandoning a decades-long policy of neutrality. Lawmakers are set to vote on the issue in the coming days. Now, as Henry Ridgewell reports from the Russian-Finnish border, such a move would have big implications for the region.
Coloured marker stones either side of a small river are all that separate Russia and Finland. For decades, the two countries have enjoyed peaceful relations. But this border could soon become a frontier between East and West, a geopolitical fault line.
The border between Finland and Russia stretches some 1,300 kilometres, much of it forests and wilderness. And if Finland does join NATO, it would become by far the longest frontier between the alliance and Russia. And that could transform this region.
Moscow has threatened what it calls a military technical response if Finland joins the alliance. There are fears the border could be a future flashpoint. Charlie Salonius-Pasternak is from the Finnish Institute of International Affairs.
Could Russia then try to take a playbook of, say, Georgia and try to create some sort of frozen conflict, invade a small part of Finland with the very few forces it has left? Certainly could try, but Finland has prepared for this militarily.
For now, there is no visible military presence. At the major Valima crossing point, there is little to indicate the emergence of any new Iron Curtain. Captain Jussi Pekala of the Finnish Border Guard oversees operations at the crossing.
We don't know what will happen and how situation will change between our countries. But at this time, situation is calm and border traffic is flowing smoothly.
When Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, there was a brief uptick in crossings.
We had a lot of persons fleeing from Russia. Of course, Europeans, Americans. Actually, we had like 52 nationalities coming.
Now, cross-border traffic is running at just 10% of normal levels. Russia's Sputnik coronavirus vaccine is not approved in Europe, so most Russians can't enter. Finland's bid to join NATO could choke off the trickle of visitors. The decline has hurt the regional economy. Frontier shopping malls are now ghost towns. Before COVID, about 2 million Russians visited Finland every year. Many stayed in Lappeenranta, a few kilometers from the border on the shores of Lake Saimaa. Kimmo Jarva is the mayor of Lappeenranta.
We have used to do cooperation with Russians. Here, for example, living more than 3,000 Russian-speaking inhabitants. It was about almost 2 million Russian coming every year in this area. But now there are coming very few tourists here. And we are losing, we have estimated that we are losing 1 million euros in every day because of this situation.
Much of what happens at this border will depend on Russia's reaction to Finland's NATO membership bid. The chill of rapidly worsening relations between East and West is keenly felt on this frontier. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Valima, Finland.
Russia's ambassador to the European Union also said that he feels deeply disappointed by the moves from Finland and Sweden to become part of NATO. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
The Kremlin has warned it may take retaliatory military technical steps after Finland's leaders says they favour joining NATO, and Sweden could do the same within days in a historic realignment triggered by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. 2.5 months after Russia's invasion of the country sent a shiver of fear through Moscow's neighbours, Finland's president and prime minister announced on Thursday that the Nordic country should apply right away for membership in NATO, the military defence pact founded in part to counter the Soviet Union. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Since the invasion of Ukraine began, the letter Z has been used by Russia as a way of identifying its military inside Ukraine. But the letter has also now become a propaganda symbol inside both Russia as well as Ukraine. VOA's Russia service explains.
It appears in social networks posts, during patriotic concerts in Russia, at pro-war rallies, and even on clothing and cars. The letter Z has become one of the Kremlin's main propaganda tools in the war against Ukraine.
I think symbols play complex roles in politics, and one of the most important of those roles is to connect emotions to specific narratives that the Kremlin and other political leaders want to get out. And so I think in this case, a symbol like Z is meant to evoke in people emotions of patriotism, loyalty.
The letters Z and V were first seen on Russian tanks mobilizing in Ukraine in the days before the invasion, but no official reason was given at the time for why they were there. One of the most common explanations associated the letters with the tank's military district, with Z standing for West and V for East. But in the first days of the war, Russia's defense ministry said the letter Z meant «за победу» for victory. That's when Russian authorities started using Z as a propaganda tool.
Typography deals with the dynamics of these symbols, letters, and numbers. It so happens that in Cyrillic, which is more relatable to Russians, there are almost no dynamic symbols. But in the Latin alphabet, there are three very dynamic letters, L, V, and Z. They are easy to write, and they are extremely dynamic.
Promoting the letter Z, experts say, is also an attempt to create national unity.
First and foremost, aimed at the Russian population itself, right? Because, like, most important for the Kremlin is to not even necessarily mobilize support for the invasion, but to demobilize opposition.
Experts say Russia's choice of the symbol is rushed and ill-considerate, because of its similarity to a Nazi swastika. And for opponents of the war in Russia and elsewhere, the letter Z has turned into a symbol of Russia's aggression as opposed to the unity of Russians.
New Nazi symbol. Very evil. Very scary.
Nazis, I guess. Yeah, that's the first thing that comes to mind.
It reminds me of the president of the Ukraine, Zelensky. Yeah. He's doing a fantastic job. He's wonderful. And I hope that's what it's reminding the people of Russia.
For many, Z has become a symbol of tragedy and war crimes. French film director Michel Hazanavicius, whose comedy titled Z opens the Cannes Festival this year, has to change the film's name to avoid any associations with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Russians who oppose the war also don't want to link with this symbol either. The bands DDT and B2 have refused to perform on stages decorated with banners sporting the letter Z. For VOA's Russian service, VOA News, Washington.
Hospitals all around Southern California are sending tons of medical supplies to Ukraine. A Los Angeles area charity foundation, Stand With Ukraine, has united hospitals around the state to aid the war-torn country. Anna Rice narrates our final story this week.
Equipment for trauma care units, for surgeries, and for intensive care units. All in all, volunteers with the Stand With Ukraine Foundation in Los Angeles, California, have collected about 10 tons of medical supplies and equipment. American oncologist and an immigrant from Ukraine, Mykola Anishenko, is among the volunteers.
Here we have lots of wound treatment material. Medication for intravenous administration. Droppers, as well as syringes, tourniquets, and drapes for patients.
Six large medical centers have donated medical equipment for Ukraine, both from Los Angeles and other regions in South California.
We put everything into different boxes. We have letters from the Ministry of Public Health, so we really know what people in Ukraine need and what they don't need so much. We're trying to prioritize.
All the boxes are marked and numbered, and soon volunteers will load them onto special cargo planes. They themselves say they didn't expect the response from medical institutions to be this impressive. After they were flooded with the first wave of donations, they had to look for more volunteers who would physically help deal with the donations. And crowds of people wanted to help, from Ukraine and the US, and from Russia and Belarus.
There's different people are helping. They just come here because they want to help sort the donations and the boxes before we ship everything to Ukraine.
In Ukraine, the precious medical cargo is passed to various charity organizations that will distribute it and send it directly to general or military hospitals located near the front lines. Co-founder of the charity foundation Stand With Ukraine LA, Mykhailo Lavris, says there will be a lot more humanitarian aid. At the moment, Stand With Ukraine is in talks with the Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center, one of the largest in the country, about shipping medical equipment and medications to Ukraine as well.
We have a request from Ukraine's Ministry of Health for specific medical equipment and medications. On top of that, we're working with the Ukrainian consulate. The Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center reached out to us and gladly provided all the things we were asking for, all the things we were lacking.
The plane with the precious cargo is scheduled to leave for Ukraine in mid-May. For Kristina Shevchenko in Los Angeles, California, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of our entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.